for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. I would also like to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. During the question and answer session, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. John Bateman. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, the media, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I will be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at, and I will spell it, nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. That's nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session at the end. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. And with that, I will introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Ira Sanchez Lugo, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the June 2023 U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is John Nielsen-Gammon, director of the Southern Regional Climate Center, who will provide a review of the extreme heat that has covered much of the southern U.S. And our third speaker is Matt Rosenkranz, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Nino update, as well as the U.S. temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for August, September, and October. Our first speaker will be Ira from NOAA NCEI.
Thank you, John, and thanks to everyone who joined in today. I'm going to go ahead and start on slide 2 to look at the global temperatures for the month of June. So the global surface temperature for June 2023 was 1.05 degrees Celsius or 1.89 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. This was the warmest June in NOAA's record that extends back to 1850, and also it was the first time a June global surface temperature departure was 1 degree Celsius, which is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. During the month, we saw warmer than average conditions across much of the world's surfaces, as you can see from both maps, with record warm June temperatures across parts of North America, Central America, Northern South America, Africa, but also across a large area in the Eastern Atlantic Ocean, the Southern Indian Ocean, and across parts of the Western Pacific Ocean. The global ocean surface temperature was 0.92 degrees Celsius or 1.66 degrees Fahrenheit above average. And not only was it record high for June, it was also the highest monthly surface temperature anomaly of any month in NOAA's 174-year record. This surpassed the previous monthly record that was set back in January 2016 by 0.05 degrees Celsius or 0.09 degrees Fahrenheit. There were some locations that did experience cooler than average June temperatures. This included Greenland, parts of the contiguous U.S., Alaska, Western Russia, southern parts of Asia, as well as parts of Eastern and Southeastern Pacific Ocean and the Northwestern Atlantic Ocean. Regionally, Africa, South America, Europe and Asia had a top 5 warm June. Moving now to slide 3 to look at the year-to-date for the globe. The global surface temperature for January through June was the third highest on record at 1.01 degrees Celsius or 1.82 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. And only the January through June period of 2016 and 2020 were warmer. The first 6 months of the year were characterized by warmer than average conditions across much of the world, with record warm temperatures across parts of Central America, South America, the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and across parts of the Pacific Ocean. Cooler than average conditions were present across parts of the western contiguous U.S., Antarctica, and small areas in southern Asia and the southeastern and eastern Pacific Ocean. Regionally, North America, South America, Europe, Africa, and Asia had a top 10 warm year to date, while Oceania, despite having an above average temperature for the January through June period, it didn't rank among the top 20 warmest Junes. Looking ahead, according to our statistical analysis, the year 2023 is virtually certain to rank among the 10 warmest years on record, and it has a little over a 95% chance of ranking among the top 5 warmest years on record. Moving now to slide number 4 to look at the contiguous U.S. During June 2023, the U.S. had above average temperatures from the northwest to the northern plains, as well as in the southern plains in Florida, while below average temperatures were observed from the southwest to the central plains and across much of the mid-Atlantic and the southeast. Averaged as a whole, the U.S. had a June temperature of 69 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 0.5 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this ranked in the middle third of the 129-year record. Statewide, North Dakota, Minnesota, Louisiana had a top 10 warm June, while West Virginia and Virginia had a top 10 cold June. In terms of precipitation, it varied across the U.S. Above average precipitation was observed across much of the West and in parts of the Southeast and New England, while below average conditions were present across the Midwest and in parts of the Northwest and Southern Plains. Statewide, again, the states of Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, and Missouri had a top 10 dry June on record, while Wyoming, Colorado, and Maine had a top 10 wet June. In terms of the billion-dollar disasters, there have been 12 confirmed weather and climate disaster events with losses exceeding $1 billion this year. These disasters consisted of 10 severe storm events, one winter storm, and one flooding event. And for the year-to-date period, the first 6 months of 2023 ranked second highest for disaster count behind 2017. Moving now to slide number 5, the January through June average temperature for the contiguous U.S. was the 21st warmest such period on record at 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit above average. As you can see from the map on the left, above average temperatures were present across much of the eastern half of the contiguous U.S., while much of the western half had near to below average temperatures during the six-month period. The state of Florida had its warmest January through June period on record, while there were an additional 28 states that had a top 10 warm year-to-date period. However, no state had a top 10 cold January through June period. Precipitation for the contiguous U.S. for the first 6 months of the year was 15.70 inches, which is 0.39 inch above average, and ranked in the middle third of the 129-year record. Precipitation was above average from California to the western Great Plains and in parts of the southern Mississippi Valley, southeast, and the northeast. Meanwhile, below average conditions were present across parts of the northwest, northern and central plains, central Mississippi Valley, and mid-Atlantic during the first 6 months of the year. Maryland had its fourth driest January through June period. However, no other state had a top 10 dry or a top 10 wet January through June period. Moving now to slide number 6 to look at the current drought conditions across the U.S. As of today, there was about 26% of the contiguous U.S. that was in some type of drought. This is about 1 percentage point less than a month ago. As you can see from the map, drought was present across much of the Midwest and across parts of the western high plains and southern region. The southwestern Florida and southern parts of the Northeast also had some type of drought. During the last month, drought conditions improved across much of the Northeast and across the eastern parts of the Midwest region, as well as parts of the high plains. Drought deteriorated across parts of the South, specifically Texas, the northern and southwestern parts of the High Plains and the northern and southeastern parts of the western U.S. Outside of the contiguous U.S., moderate drought was present across parts of Hawaii and Puerto Rico, while the moderate drought was present across the U.S. Virgin Islands. That is all I have for today. I will now turn it over to Dr. Nielsen-Gammon.
Thank you very much. I'm John Nielsen-Gammon. In addition to being director of the Southern Regional Climate Center, I serve as a Texas state climatologist, and I'm a faculty member at Texas A&M University in College Station. I'll be focusing on the heat in the area of responsibility for the Southern Regional Climate Center, which stretches from Texas to Tennessee, including four states in between. Slide 7 shows the number of record maximum high temperatures that were set during the month of June, and I've added in, for the sake of statistics, perspective for the first half of July as well. The peak of the heat wave in the south was June 20th through 22nd. Each of those days set at least three dozen daily temperature records across the south. Most of this was in Texas. Louisiana later on was affected by the heat and set a few high temperature records as well. But 399 total for the period from the beginning of June to the middle of July. Slide number 8 shows the number of minimum temperature records that were set. We do have occasional relatively cool weather as well. That was not predominantly in Texas. That was mainly in Tennessee during the first part of June. And then in northern parts of the region, Oklahoma and Arkansas did set a few minimum temperature records in early July. Slide number 9 shows the comparison, though, between the maximum temperature records and the minimum temperature records. You can see maximum temperature records predominated throughout the period, especially when the heat was going on. I should mention these are preliminary records. It's possible there's one or two erroneous readings in here, but certainly the overall trend is clear. In addition to daily records, there were also a handful of monthly records, and even 8 all-time temperature records were set during the June heat wave. Those 8 stations were in Texas, basically from west-central Texas down to south Texas. Texas did not set its all-time statewide temperature record. It came within 1 degree of doing so, as a station in the Big Bend area reached 119 degrees Fahrenheit, 1 degree short of the record of 120 degrees, which was set in the 1930s and tied again in the 1990s. Slide number 10 shows how hot it's gotten in June on the left-hand panel, and so the first half of July on the right-hand panel. So this is a map of each location's highest temperature for the period. 100 degrees and above is in the light orange on both panels, and you can see most of Texas and about half of Oklahoma reached triple digits, as well as portions of Louisiana, Arkansas, and Mississippi. In July, the intensity of the heat has been less. There's much less area which reached 110 degrees or above. But 100-degree weather has spread farther east, affecting more of the area around Dallas and Houston and approaching Louisiana as well. Minimum temperatures are a problem as well, especially when you're in a heat wave, because body needs to cool off at night. If there's no air conditioning available, the ambient temperature is what matters. Slide 11 shows basically the hottest nights in June and the first half of July. Red is where the temperature never dropped below 80 degrees Fahrenheit on at least one day. And dark red is where it never dropped below 84 degrees Fahrenheit, which shows up at a few places along the coast, including the New Orleans area. in contrast to the maximum temperatures, we see more intense heat at night in July than we saw in June, so that there's much more widespread area in North Texas, which hasn't dropped below 80 degrees Fahrenheit on at least one day. The causes for the June heat wave are fairly complex, basically because there's a large number of causes. Anytime you have something that's record-setting or near record-setting, you typically have a variety of contributing factors to it. So in this case, one factor was just the overall increase of temperatures that we're seeing globally. You heard about June being a record hot temperature globally. In Texas and much of the South, temperatures have increased by about 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit compared to the early part of the 20th century. In addition to that, it's being an unusually hot year. And in the Gulf of Mexico, where the air feeds into most of the southern United States, the water temperatures have been unusually hot. According to NOAA data, it was the second hottest June on record for the Gulf of Mexico. So that sets things up for being fairly hot. And then a couple of other factors come in the short term to kick things up a notch. Slide number 12. On the left, we have the upper-level jet stream pattern. Those contours swinging south and north show the position of the jet stream. And there was an upper-level anticyclone colored in red over northern Mexico, which colloquially is known as a heat dome when it occurs in the summertime. And that causes warm temperatures for several reasons. First, when you have one of those, you typically have sinking air, and air warms as it sinks. Secondly, in that particular location, it brings air over the high altitude terrain of northern Mexico and the southwest United States, and then takes it over Texas, so that we have basically superheated air in Texas that allows for that air to mix down to the ground and produce high local temperatures. On the right is the air temperature anomalies compared to normal for altitude about 1 mile above the ground, and temperatures were 10 degrees Celsius above normal for the three-day period during the peak of the heat wave above the ground, and that, of course, allowed the ground to warm up as well. In contrast that, in slide 13 for July, we do have a bit of a heat dome in place. It's not as localized, and it's not causing the extreme high temperatures aloft that we saw in June. Basically, we've transitioned from a weather-driven heat wave in Texas to more of a climate-driven heat wave. The high temperatures and lack of rain during the past month and a half have dried out the soil, and now the sun's heat basically heats the ground and heats the air without any energy being diverted to evaporation. So we're looking at persistently warm temperatures, at least possible, given the conditions in the ocean and on the land surface presently. Last set of slides I want to highlight show the departures from normal of the surface temperatures within the region. Slide 14 covers the month of June, and it doesn't look all that impressive. There's a couple of cities in southern Texas that were 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, but on the whole, it wasn't that hot because it started out as a relatively mild June. The heat only turned on substantially during the second half. So slide 15 shows the temperature anomalies during the last 2 weeks of June, and there we see 5 to 9 degrees above normal widespread across most of Texas and parts of Louisiana, with northern areas, Oklahoma through Tennessee, still having normal to below normal conditions. So far in July, slide 16 shows that we're still running 3 to 5 degrees above normal across most of Texas and Louisiana and coastal Mississippi, but it's still nonetheless been relatively mild to the north across Oklahoma to Tennessee. They're still running below normal. Just a brief short-term outlook on what's going on. We're going to get a cool front coming through on Friday. Saturday will probably be the relatively mildest day in a while for this region. But then the heat will crank up again, and you'll find people in the Midwest complaining as some of that hot air heads in their direction. We don't like to hog all the hot weather down here in the South. So that's what's been going on with the heat. I'll turn it over to Matt Rosenkranz to talk about what's going on in the future.
Hello, everyone. It's Matt Rosenkranz and from the Climate Prediction Center. And on slide 17, there's a couple images here. We talk about, and it's referencing the sea surface temperature anomalies for the last month. There's a lot of abnormally warm waters in the central and eastern Pacific, and that's related to the ongoing El Nino. We are in an El Nino advisory right now. We've been since May, and that continued through the advisory in July. The sea surface temperatures that are above normal in the equatorial Pacific are causing some of the winds there to respond, though the response and the winds and the coupling between the ocean and the atmosphere, it's a bit weaker than maybe might be expected for an El Nino advisory at this point, you know, been for 2 months. But we are starting to see some changes in the wind patterns, both locally in the Pacific and even some globally that can be attributed to that changing state from that we were in La Nina for a couple of years in a row, now into the El Nino state currently. The sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic, particularly the eastern Atlantic off the coast of Africa, are well above normal for the last 30 days, and that's about 18 June to 15 July is the data period that I have. The month of June was quite warm in parts of the Gulf of Mexico. It's interesting, too, it's kind of a flip from May when you had some cooler waters kind of off in the eastern Gulf and even on the east coast of off the east coast of Florida. Now, I mean, just I only see some below normal temperatures in the Atlantic up off the coast of Canada. Almost the entire rest of the Atlantic Ocean is above normal. There are temperature anomalies at least 2 degrees centigrade above normal, you know, on the positive side there, off the west coast of Africa. So it's quite the interesting dynamic to have both of the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean basins so warm, so anomalously warm at the same time. Looking forward to the future, we are expecting this El Nino to continue. There's at least a 90% chance of El Nino continuing through the Northern Hemisphere winter season of December, January, and February into 2024. And that will likely have impacts downstream on the U.S. Climate. Moving to slide 18, this is our outlooks for August. August has some impact from the ongoing El Nino. Typically that's with the drier conditions out in the western U.S., El Ninos are typically associated with reduced precipitation totals in the monsoon region. That can also act to have some of those feedback mechanisms that Professor NG just mentioned, where once you get dry, then your heating of your sun, which is still strong in August, can then lead to higher temperatures. And so we do have a forecast for above normal temperatures favored through much of the Southwest Four Corners region. And that does extend to the Pacific Northwest, where there is some drought there currently. And then that also extends across the southern tier of the U.S. And wrapping up into the Northeast, where the trends during the month of August for the past 15 years do show above normal temperatures. We actually do have an area of below normal temperatures favored in the northern plains. And that's because of the circulations that are typically induced by El Nino conditions. You can get they are associated with troughing and low pressure systems kind of over the Great Lakes region. And you can get some bouts of cool weather to pull down on the western side of those troughs. And that could impact some of the northern plains and up in the Mississippi Valley. Along the southern side of that, you are likely to have some storm track and storm activity. We've seen some of that already with repeated heavy rain events moving across kind of parts of Kansas and eastern Oklahoma and then trending into the eastern U.S. into the southeast. We've seen some of that already in July, and then some of that is likely to continue from the area from Nebraska down to northern Mississippi and eastward to the east coast, ranging anywhere from Massachusetts down to about the coast of Georgia. That box is all favored to have above normal precipitation during the month of August. Moving to slide 19, the temperature outlook for August, September, and October favors above normal temperatures from the Pacific Northwest to the Four Corners region, across the southern tier of the U.S., and up into the Northeast. The Southwest and the Four Corners region have the highest odds for above normal temperatures at greater than 60%. And again, that's where we think there will be warm temperatures during August and then September as well, really with associated with potentially reduced precipitation during the monsoon. So that should really favor above normal temperatures in that region. Trends are quite strong in that region as well, so that's another predictor that we look at. There is an area below normal temperatures on the seasonal outlook here, out of northern Missouri up to south to kind of southeastern South Dakota. It's a slightly smaller area than is indicated on the forecast for August, and that's just because that cool trend there, that cool area from on the backside of the trough for the Great Lakes, and the same reason there, it does tend to fade as you get towards October and you start to set up more of a transition pattern. So we should see some of that fade out. So that's why probabilities are lower on this seasonal outlook. Northeast, there are still strong trends in August and September for above normal temperatures. So that really played a factor in this outlook as well. For the precipitation outlook, we are thinking that the Pacific Northwest will have below normal precipitation during August, September, October. We're looking at the Southwest having a reduced amplitude of their monsoon. So that should lead to August and September and October being below normal for precipitation in kind of parts of eastern Arizona and western New Mexico, western parts of Colorado and Utah, so the Four Corners region. And then above normal precipitation is favored kind of from Nebraska down to eastern Texas, across Louisiana, and off to the kind of mid-Atlantic coast, including the Carolinas. There is potential for that part of that early part of the period to have some of that troughing and storm activity moving from west to east across that region associated with El Nino. We do often also see when the monsoon is dry, the plains are wet. That is a common dipole that has been identified in much of the academic literature. For the seasonal temperature outlook for Alaska, they are expecting above normal temperatures for August, September, October. We have noticed some ice edge retreat along western Alaska, and we have also noticed some sea surface temperatures getting above normal in the Bering Strait area. Where those temperatures were below normal for the past couple of months, we are starting to see some of those temperatures get to above normal now. And that should kind of reinforce some of the trends that are observed over the land and not be a kind of mitigating factor there. And as some of those sea surface temperatures may be above normal and there may be some later ice edge impacts, you can end up with above normal precipitation along the southwest and western portions of Alaska. Next slide, and it's slide 20. The drought outlook does favor some drought development in the Pacific Northwest associated with the potential for the below normal precipitation during August and September and October. That area did not benefit as much from the winter rains from 2022 to 2023 winter, from those winter rains and winter snowpack during that time period, so there's much less residual storage capacity there. In the southwest Four Corners region, there's some drought development likely there due to the increased potential for a kind of a reduced amplitude monsoon that is indicated in the August and August, September, October outlooks. There are some indications for drought improvement and potential drought removal in the plains from northern Oklahoma up to southern Minnesota and southern Wisconsin. You could end up with some drought removal there as you end up with some cooler conditions potentially in the outlook and some wetter conditions for much of those during the August, September, October period. Across northern North Dakota, northern Minnesota, and northern Wisconsin, there is the potential for some of the drought there to largely persist through the August, September, October period, but there could be places of localized drought improvement due to smaller scale storms, thunderstorms, or even a mesoscale complex that goes through there and can drop a lot of rain, but over a very small area. We are also expecting drought persistence and development across much of Texas and potentially southwest Louisiana, and that could be some reinforcing and positive feedback cycles from that heat and dryness that the professor mentioned a couple minutes ago. That's all I have, and I'll turn it back to John.
Thanks so much, Matt. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question, if possible. And Lisa, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your request, press star 2. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please, for the first question. Our first question comes from Seth Borenstein of the AP. You may ask your question.
Yes, thank you. I actually have one for both Matt and one for John. For Matt, in terms, I know you told us was national. In terms of if just what we're looking at for the rest of the summer, in terms of globally, it has been an incredibly wild summer, not just heat, but extremes. Given what we're seeing right now, what does the second half of the summer look like are we looking at more of the same, worse, slight easing, a lot of easing, and why? And a quick corollary, are you basically for the Southwest saying the monsoon, which hasn't shown up, is just going to be missing in action all year, just won't show up? And for John, can you put when Ira showed Texas, did not have one of a top 5 hottest June, only because of the first half of the June, as you mentioned. Can you describe, put in context, what especially the last month, from mid-June to mid-July, has been like in historical context? Is this sort of the most brutal summer you've seen in the South, or is it not really that, not as bad? A little more language and less statistics, if you don't mind, even though I love statistics.
All right. This is Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. For the rest of August, the rest of the second half and the second half of the summer, including the rest of July, we are expecting the later parts of July to be quite warm across parts of the southern parts of the U.S., the southern plains, and some of that heat is likely to push northward into the upper Mississippi Valley and to the northern plains, and even out into the central Rockies. So it is likely to be quite a warm period in the second half of July, kind of a bit of more of the same on that, but even further north than we have seen from the end of June into early July. For August, we are expecting a bit of that to retreat in the northern plains, but the southern tier of the U.S. and even to the Pacific Northwest could end up with another, period of quite warm weather, quite extreme weather during the month of August. For for temperature-wise. For precipitation, the outlooks do not indicate that the monsoon will be it will fail to show up, but it will. You'll have less days and less intensity of the monsoon overall. So therefore, you'll end up with a below normal total seasonal and monthly total of precipitation in the Southwest. We are seeing some indications and some setups and some of the pictures that and images that Professor Nielsen Gammon showed with some high pressures moving to the further to the west into the Four Corners region. That does set you up for some better monsoonal activity than we have seen during the kind of early parts of July. So we should start to see some more monsoon activity, but overall it's still likely to be more spotty, potentially, and not as active as in the past climatological years that we use in our analysis.
And what about globally? Are we looking how bad, how hot globally?
I don't do an outlook for the globe.
Thank you. And John?
Yeah, thank you. John Nielsen Gammon. The heat, so far in terms of historical, part of the problem is Texas is a big state. For the basically the southwestern half of the state from mid-June on, this has been the hottest summer on record, or at least top five, depending upon location. El Paso is now at 34 days of consecutive days over 100 degrees and counting. And one of the really difficult aspects of this heat wave was when it kicked in, there had been plenty of rain in April and May, and so that combined with the high Gulf of Mexico temperatures meant that the humidity was unusually high. So we saw heat indexes, which, although we don't have data for that going back all the way to the beginning of the century, were probably close to all-time record-setting, if not all-time record-setting in a few places. As time goes on, that humidity has decreased a little bit, but it's still on track to being one of the hottest, if not the hottest summer in many places in South and Southwest Texas.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from James Dineen of New Scientist.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, my question is for Matt Rosenkranz. I saw in the most recent NOAA ENSO discussion from July 13th that there was there's a 1 in 5 chance of a, quote, historic El Nino developing this year. When is that forecast likely to become clearer? And can you say more about what downstream effects there might be from a very strong El Nino on U.S. climate on top of this background of strong global warming?
Sure. So, yes, yeah, so some of the models and things we look at have indicated that we could be in record territory for where we would get to with our measure of El Nino, the ONI value, which is based on temperatures in the Pacific. There's currently a 52% chance right now that it would get to greater than 1.5 degrees. Which would put it in the upper echelons of some of in our strong event category. There's a 52% chance of that happening during October, November, December of 2023. Should that happen and maintain through the winter, it would likely be a quite warm winter over much of the lower 48. The more variable in the results that happen over Alaska. But it could be quite a warm winter over much of the lower 48. Last time we had a strong El Nino for the winter, it was above normal temperatures were observed across the entire lower 48 or contiguous U.S.
And can you say when we might have a clearer sense of whether that upper echelon strong or a historically strong El Nino will develop? I mean, is that something we'll have a clear sense of by August or by September?
By September. That's about, so I mean, because the highest probabilities we're looking at now are during October, November, December, so you probably get that in the beginning parts of September.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Rebecca Hersher of NPR.
Hello. My question is for John. I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit more on the phenomenon he described where hot temperatures dry up the soil and then the sun is able to heat the soil even more. I think that's an important phenomenon, but one that's not super familiar to a lot of people. So if you could just elaborate a little bit more on how that happens and what the effects are for people who live in places it's happening.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. This is John. Basically, when the sun doesn't heat the air directly very much, the sunlight goes through the air, which is why we are able to see things through the air as well, and it reaches the soil where it gets absorbed as energy. And then that energy can either be used to heat the ground itself or to evaporate any water that's available on the ground and in plants and so forth. And so as a general rule, the more evaporation that takes place, the less the amount of heating that takes place. So as things dry out, as you run out of water to evaporate, all of the energy is able to go into heating the ground, which then heats up the air above the ground, and when we get the heat as a result of that. There's also a potential climate feedback loop there, because with less water available to evaporate, there's less water in the air to form clouds and precipitation in areas where daytime thunderstorms are common. And that means that the water in the ground is not replenished. And so if things get on the dry side, they tend to dry out even more. Whereas things are wet, they tend to stay wet. And the southern plains of the United States is one of the parts of the globe where that feedback mechanism can kick in. So that feedback's been triggered by the heat wave we had in June, and so now that things are dry, they're more likely to stay dry and hot.
Our next question comes from Mose Bushel of NPR Austin.
Hey, this one's for John, too. How you doing, John?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks.
You mentioned, I thought it was interesting the way you described switching from a weather to climate-driven heat. And I was hoping maybe you could just go into a little more detail about how the heat we've seen, be it this anomalous June heat or the heat we're in now, has been exacerbated by or at very least consistent with what we expect from global climate change, global warming.
Okay, yeah. Global climate change in general affects our weather in two ways. One is just sort of the direct effect of temperatures. And so in that respect, with temperatures having increased in Texas by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the 1970s because of climate change, we could say that temperatures during this heat wave are about 2 degrees warmer than they would have been. The other aspect is what we call dynamical, how it affects the weather patterns, how it affects weather systems. Whether the heat dome forming over the Southwest was more or less likely because of climate change. That's a bit of a harder question. There's been some research pointing to increased likelihood of jet stream patterns that tend to lock in place during the summertime. But whether that specific pattern we had in June was one of those things isn't clear at the moment. So it's hard to say whether that sort of influence was acting in this particular heat wave. Last thing in those lines I'll comment on is that because of the higher temperatures, we get more rapid evaporation of water, and so that feedback mechanism I talked about kicks in sooner and temperatures get hotter faster because we lose the cooling effect of the water more rapidly as it evaporates more rapidly because of the higher overall temperatures.
Yeah, maybe I could get a quick follow-up just on that, the way that operated this year, because we had such a nice spring and into early June. Maybe this isn't a fair question, but was this a surprise? I mean, I feel like a lot of people felt like we might get a nicer start to the summer because it was wet and cool in the spring, and then suddenly, bam, we're stuck with a summer that looks like it last summer, which was also extremely hot.
Well, it's sort of a problem between weather and climate. And actually, I think I'd rather have Matt answer that question because he was actually involved in, you know, figuring out long-term what might happen this summer. If you're game for it.
Got anything to say, Matt?
Yeah, so within the context, hey, John, this is Matt Rosenkranz, Climate Prediction Center. The explanation and the difference between the weather and the climate really does come into play here, where 2 weeks of a month can be one temperature, you know, regime, and, you know, the other 2 weeks be another temperature regime, and if one is just more amplified, that can overwhelm the statistics for the month. Our seasonal outlook for the summertime, when I go back and look at our May, June, July outlook, the summertime had a lot of above normal temperatures across the southern tier of the U.S. And that, you know, didn't start out that way, but then it seems to be kind of finishing that way. Doing an attribution of that, it could have been that flip in El Nino state. It could have been flips in other oscillations that kind of drove that change during the month. We did go from a largely no, I don't see anything as far as the global scale oscillation in the northern hemisphere, the Arctic oscillation that would have changed dramatically, and I don't see anything in the state of it. The indices that I have available to look at right now really quickly while on this call, I don't see anything that would have changed there. So we'd have to look at the attribution of that, what changed in the atmosphere to change the circulation pattern over that, just to have that quick flip right in the middle of the month. We do notice that El Niños do tend to have that troughing and pull some cooler air down into the central plains. How far south that makes it, it could have just been that it wasn't able to make it quite a bit further south during May and early parts of June, and then as the seasonal cycle comes along, it isn't able to make it as far south, and that could just be the difference. It could be part of the seasonal cycle where it's not quite locked in north-south as much.
The next question comes from Eric Kneeler of the Wall Street Journal.
Hi, thanks for putting this together. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
So just quickly, two things. If you take your, John, if you look at your readings and forecasts for the central south, and you just shift it a little bit to the left in the southwestern U.S., we've seen just tremendous temperatures in Phoenix, southern Nevada, parts of California, and so forth. What's happening there, and when will that region get some relief? And then just on the macro scale, how does this end? I mean, this heat dome that's been sitting there, what kind of pattern or energy or physical thing is going to knock it so that it either moves or dissipates?
John, do you want to take that or do you want me to take that?
I think I prefer to leave that one to you. I can comment on it after you're done.
All right. So Matt Rosenkranz, Climate Prediction Center. The Southwest has experienced some very intense heat recently. Our outlook for August and for August, September, October, how they both favor a continuation of above normal temperatures in that region. There may be a slight relief coming towards the beginning of August. It may be just because the monsoon will kick in at some point and you will end up with some more cloud cover, potential rainy days. That is one mechanism that could kind of shake that up and change the circulation pattern for at least the Southwest. But again, we are favoring above normal temperatures for the next 3 months over the Southwest. It's actually got my highest odds of above normal temperatures are in the Southwest U.S. in the Four Corners region. As far as what could shake that and change that pattern, you can end up with tropical storms are a big changer of the circulation pattern. So if you end up with tropical storms that form off the coast of Mexico and move up to the Northwest, they can bring a large moisture surge into the Southwest. They can also then also result in changing the wind patterns downstream of those. You can also have tropical cyclones that form in the Western Pacific and move kind of up near Korea or near Japan, and they can shake whatever is residual in the jet stream in the summertime over there and lead to changes. Those typically happen a bit later in the season, a bit later in the calendar, more of a September-October time period for both of those scenarios. So it does look like August could be a continuation of the hot, but maybe not as intense. As we've seen in the early part of August, but the later part of August could definitely return to above normal temperatures.
Okay, thank you.
Don, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'll just, at least for the southern United States, particularly another way of breaking the pattern, ironically, is having the high pressure system expand eastward, because right now, as you might be able to see on slide 13, you've got that localized high pressure, and the air is circulating clockwise around that, so that the air is sort of stuck over the Southwest. If that ridge elongates, then the air to the south of that can be coming from the Atlantic and from the Gulf of Mexico and feeding into West Texas and New Mexico and bringing tropical moisture with it. So there's lots of ways the pattern can be tweaked, but unfortunately the Southwest U.S. is one of the parts of the globe that geographically high pressure systems like to camp out on top of, so it does take something to move them out of the way.
Thanks a lot.
Our next question comes from Dalger Ergensana. You may ask your question.
Hi, this question is for Mr. Nielsen-Gammon. I understand what you're saying about the June heat wave in Texas and northern Mexico being mainly weather-driven, but I have heard from like a couple of other researchers who have done sort of general global attribution studies looking at like how much attributing extreme temperatures, not for specific heat waves like this, but in general to climate change, from Climate Central and also from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. I don't know if you've seen their work, but, you know, they have said that the high temperatures we saw last month were like about five times more likely because of climate change and about 5 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than they would have been. And I was just wondering what you think of that kind of research. If you think that's reasonable and reliable.
Yeah, thank you. I'm familiar with the research in general. I haven't looked at what they've done specifically in this case, but a couple of ways to reconcile these. One is, generally speaking, the larger scale, the bigger the relative importance of climate versus weather. So, for example, the global temperature, June being hottest on record. That's something that was extremely unlikely to happen this year without climate change, and is much more likely with it. As you get down to, that's because temperatures don't vary by more than a couple degrees from one June to the next on a global average. Locally, temperatures vary by 5 degrees or more, averaged over a month, and even more from 1 week to the next. And so, to that extent, climate change has a relatively small proportional impact in terms of the magnitude of the event. On the other hand, as you get to more extreme events, the change in odds becomes particularly key, because you can have events that were so hot that they may not have been possible at all without the extra couple degrees increment due to climate change. And so climate change can enable extreme events even at the local level that theoretically weren't possible or were almost impossible otherwise. So both of those things are in play. The difference in between large scale and small scale climate anomalies, and the difference between the amount of temperature change attributable and the change in the odds attributable to climate.
Our final question comes from Leonie Jorg of ZDF German TV.
Hi, my question would be for John. And I'm interested about the jet stream pattern, because from my understanding, the jet stream is really changing. And I wanted to ask how unusual the pattern this year is and what consequences would go along with a jet stream that is changing that much.
Okay. So, John, again, I haven't looked at the jet stream pattern for the month and year in general. The sorts of things we're seeing with the jet stream in terms of trends are a slight tendency for it to be a bit farther north and a bit weaker as well. Those are relatively small changes, potentially more consequential sort of tendency for the wavy patterns in the jet stream to get locked into place. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, I don't know whether this particular pattern we saw in June was one of those. It seemed like it was a smaller scale than the one that's being attributed to having a direct influence from climate change. So unfortunately, I don't think I can give you a satisfactory answer.
Okay, thank you.
This concludes the question and answer session.
All right. Thanks so much. If there are no other questions, I will wrap up the call. I will end by reminding you to mark your calendar for a few upcoming events. The release of the July 2023 U.S. Climate Report is scheduled for August 8th. The release of the July 2023 Global Climate Report is scheduled for August 14th. And NOAA will hold its next monthly U.S. and global climate media call at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, August 17th. And lastly, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site later today. If you have any further informational needs, please feel free to email me, John Bateman. My contact information is available at the top of the media advisory. Thank you.